Hello and welcome to this week's Home is Where the Hearth is podcast. Thanks as always for joining me and for being a member of the Inner Sanctum. And we're going to continue this week with our discussion of Macbeth. This will actually be concluding our long time series. I don't know how many weeks, but many weeks, where we have been looking at the text that I taught back in the autumn. For an imaginative literature class, we've looked at basically great works by Homer, the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Divine Comedy, Canterbury Tales, and then thence to several plays by Shakespeare, which this will be the last. So we've got two more weeks on Macbeth, and then I will have to think about what we're going to do next in the Home is Where the Hearth is podcast. But for now, let's continue. So we've been sort of, there's 15 questions for each text. We normally cover about 5 questions in each podcast. So this being the second of the 3, we're beginning with question 6 of the discussion questions I wrote in that course. So without further ado, to what extent does the reaction to Macbeth's actions by characters such as Banquo and Lennox contribute to the tragedy in terms of their responses and reaction to events? To what extent do resistance and defiance, or submissions and compromise, contribute to the unfolding of events? Okay, so of course, one of the great things about literature in general, drama particularly, and perhaps Shakespeare especially, is to teach lessons, if you like, about life in accordance with the consequences of actions, that bad actions, evil actions, invariably have evil consequences, but also that those evil consequences do not just impact the evil characters, though they do, evil being self-destructive, also there are innocent victims. And one of the great recurring motifs in Shakespeare is how do the virtuous respond to the wickedness that they are affronted with or confronted by? And of course, the test of virtue ultimately is remaining virtuous in spite of the temptation to abandon virtue in the face of wickedness, in the presence of wickedness. And to suffer the consequences if necessary. In other words, to take up the cross and even to be willing to be crucified as our Lord and Saviour was crucified in defiance of evil. Failure to do that actually contributes towards the evil. And I think one of the lessons we see in the response of characters such as Banquo and Lennox is that a failure to respond virtuously in the presence of vice, viciousness, evil, contributes to the evil. And although the courage to respond virtuously in the presence of evil invariably involves suffering for the innocent and the virtuous soul, who in some ways becomes a victim of the evil, nonetheless, the willingness to embrace suffering in the cause of goodness actually helps to heal society and to bring goodness, if you like, the leaven, the yeast of goodness, back into the culture, without which we'd have nothing but the culture of death. Okay, question 7. Contextually, connecting the play with the times and the politics of Shakespeare's day, what might be the connection between Macbeth and James I? Well, this is a huge question, and in my introduction to the Ignatius Critical Edition of Macbeth, I spend several hundred words discussing this. Basically, that the English hopes, English Catholic hopes, were all on King James, the accession of King James I to the throne, because under Elizabeth, obviously, there'd been nothing but hideous persecution of Catholicism. She was getting old, so the Catholics just were hanging on for her passing. And then the accession to the throne of King James I, who was James VI of Scotland, who would then become King James I of England. whose mother was Mary, Queen of Scots, a devout Catholic. And although James himself was a Protestant, he had married a woman who was Catholic and had made it clear that he intended to show tolerance towards the Catholics in the kingdom following his accession to the throne. He reneged on that promise and kept up, continued with the policy of persecuting England's Catholics in the same manner as his predecessor, Elizabeth I. This led to a great deal of anger amongst the Catholics, also in some despondency. Many Catholics surrendered finally and conformed to the state religion, abandoning their faith in the realization that with a young king on the throne, there could be decades of further persecution. Many buckled under that prospect. At the other extreme, young hotheads were moved to violence and became involved in conspiracies such as the Gunpowder Plot. So this anger is present in Shakespeare as the Catholic living in these times in various ways. First of all, let's look at a few parallels and analogies. Macbeth is the Scottish play. King James I is, of course, Scottish. It's about a Scottish king. King James, of course, is the Scottish king on the throne. The analogy, the parallel would have been patently obvious to Shakespeare's audience. Even the name Macbeth. Now, Macbeth is an authentic king in Scottish history. But surely Shakespeare and his audience would have been aware that Macbeth actually means, taken literally, the son of Beth, in other words, the son of Elizabeth. Now, this would, of course, be a very painful insult to King James, because it was Elizabeth who actually gave the orders, almost certainly, for the execution of James's mother, Mary, Queen of Scots. So to call the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, the son of the woman who murdered his mother, or had his mother executed, perhaps we don't want to be too over the top in our language, would have been certainly a very powerful riposte to the wickedness of the king. King James I also was implicated in what became known as the Gowrie Plot, in which some Scottish nobles were put to death for an alleged conspiracy against King James. This is a few years before King James became King of England. But that Gowrie plot, the Gowrie conspiracy, was largely believed to be a fabrication by the king in order to destroy a family, the Gowrie family, to whom he owed a lot of money. And not only was it by making himself a victim of the so-called conspiracy, was able to execute the leaders of that family. He also awarded himself in compensation for their wickedness, that family's land. So not only did he wipe out the debt he owed them, he also actually inherited their land. So many people thought this was just a Machiavellian piece of evil intriguing by King James. So what clearly Shakespeare is doing here is making the implication that King James I, the King of England, is very much like this wicked King Macbeth. Could say more on it, but that's probably sufficient within the context of this podcast. Question 8. What is the purpose or significance of the reference to King Edward the Confessor? Does he serve as a counterpoint to Macbeth? Well, yes, so Edward the Confessor was the last king of Saxon England, reigning in the 1060s prior to the Norman conquest in 1066. A very holy king, hence the fact he's canonized, Saint Edward the Confessor, was seen as the patron saint of England until the Crusaders brought back a devotion to Saint George. So what does Shakespeare do with him? He doesn't appear as a character in the play, but he is the King of England, south of the border, while Macbeth is intriguing, north of the border in Scotland. He's the contemporary king in England. And what Shakespeare does is to compare and, more to the point, contrast the holiness of King Edward the Confessor, Saint Edward the Confessor, who is referred to by characters in the play as being holy, good, having, because of his sanctity, his holiness, healing powers. Just by touching the sick, he had power to heal them. This was actually something which was said of St. Edward the Confessor historically, as something factually. Shakespeare takes that historical fact and inserts it into his own play as a way of showing the difference between a wicked Machiavellian king, such as Macbeth, aka, as we've seen, King James I, and the good holy Catholic kings of England in the past, such as St. Edward the Confessor. Okay, where are we now? Question 9. Macbeth shares with Romeo and Juliet the breathless rapidity of plot development. It's as if both plays are characterized by recklessness and rashness of judgment, and that this dynamic accelerates what's happening. What does the breathless speed of the action say about the moral aspects of the drama? Okay, so basically, in terms of this sort of, should we say, this the form of the play, which is sort of defined, if you like, by the pace at which the play moves, Macbeth can be seen as paralleling Romeo and Juliet. The thing about Romeo and Juliet as characters is that they are reckless in their behaviour. They follow their passion, heedless and headless of the consequences. They see everything through the light, or more to the point, the darkness of their loins, to see reality through our loins instead of our heart and our head is clearly going to be destructive. And so that Shakespeare has that everything, once these two lovers, to use the term in the broadest sense, accept and embrace the reckless consequences of their relationship, everything spirals downward at an accelerated pace, and the whole action's over in a few days. Macbeth, same thing. Once Macbeth decides he's going to act upon the insidious, invidious, evil promptings of the weird sisters, of the witches, of basically the demonic presence in the play, that things very quickly get out of control, and the complications caused by the initial evil actions have further ramifications. And in the end, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth have little option from the point of view of retaining the power they've gained by continuing to exterminate all opponents with destructive and ultimately self-destructive consequences. So very similar in form with Romeo and Juliet, that once we choose the path of recklessness, then we will be wrecked on the circumstances that very quickly get out of our control. And finally, question 10. The play begins with characters expressing affection and swearing fealty to one another. How are these feelings and promises honoured? To what extent are definitions of love and loyalty fluid? To what extent do they change throughout the play? Okay, so again, there's the authentic thing, and there is what we say and do in relation to the authentic thing. In other words, there's objective reality and the way that we subjectively do things to it. So again, to remain loyal, to remain a lover in the sense of one who chooses to sacrifice himself for another, requires action, requires proving ourselves in relation to the thing itself. If we are claiming to practice love, then the proof of the pudding is in the self-sacrifice for others. To use the word love and then act selfishly is not just hypocrisy, it's actually putting ourselves on the diabolical, diametrical end of the spectrum as regards good and evil. Same thing to claim loyalty. Well, to claim that one is loyal, one again must act self-sacrificially in proof of one's loyalty. The failure to do so makes one an enemy of all that is loyal and true, all that is truly love. So again, what we see, and it's a recurring motif in Shakespeare, there is authentic, objective reality, and authentic people subject themselves to that authentic reality. Evil characters, Machiavellian characters, try to manipulate reality by using words falsely and by failing to live up to the objective demands that reality commands of them. And that is the difference ultimately between virtue and vice, and between goodness and evil, between good characters and evil characters, and between heaven and hell. And on that note, we'll conclude this week's Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast. Please do join me next week as we conclude our discussion of Shakespeare's Macbeth. Until then, have a very blessed Lenten week.